Hello everyone, this is Dave Levinsky from Growth Inc., and today I'm really excited to be able to interview Steve Kaplan. Steve Kaplan is a very accomplished entrepreneur, investor, and educator. Steve's background includes founding and growing the number two ranked promotion, marketing, and database company in America, which had 1,300 employees in 21 countries and over $250 million in sales. And he accomplished that by the age of 35. Steve's done a lot since then, and he currently owns several businesses, most notably the Difference Maker, Inc., which provides business tools to large and small businesses. Steve has written New York Times bestsellers, Bag the Elephant, Getting and Keeping Big Customers, and Be the Elephant, Build a Bigger, Better Business. He's also written Sell Your Business for the Max, all great books that you can find on Amazon.com or wherever business books are sold. Because of Steve's amazing background, I'm really excited to interview him today on the topic of how to effectively grow a company. But to begin, Steve, I wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Oh, yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. So I want to start with sort of the financials of running a successful company. What are the key numbers that a business owner must understand and keep track of when running their business?
Well, I mean, of course, you have the obvious ones, you know, cash flow, the lifeblood of your organization and things mm-hmm. like that that people know. And profitability, without profitability and margin, of course, your cash flow catches up to you when you have a big economic crisis like we see around us, you know, with the banking industry.
Right.
So those are the typical statements, but really the things that that for me that are the key drivers of growing your business. You have things, you know, such as margins in your business and your cost of your sales organizations. These are some things that typically business owners really don't look at. And one of the things I like to look at is it's almost like a ratio. Like, what, you know, take your salespeople, you know, what are you paying them, which all in, you know, their travel and entertainment, their benefits, their everything, their taxes, everything, mm-hmm. you know, and divide that by the money they're bringing in, not the sales, but the profit that they're bringing in. Get a ratio of that and group your salespeople. You'd be surprised if you have three salespeople or 30 or 300, the ones that you think are your top salespeople are not going to be your top salespeople. But by doing that exercise, it's going to point out a couple of really critical things for margins. It's going to help you stop, you know, some of the hemorrhaging if that's going on, or more importantly, you know, see what's doing good and benefit on that. And that rolls up into, you know, all the other general statements that we all know about, and especially, you know, important when you're selling businesses and that kind of thing.
Excellent. That's a really interesting way to look at it. And so you're saying that when you take your sales force, look at the ratio, look at the total cost of each salesperson based on their salary, I guess, bonuses and travel, and divide by the actual profit that they bring in, not just sales.
Yeah, Dave, if we're sitting in a room, you'd be surprised. If there's 10 people in the room and I say to them, and I've done this before, you know, who's your top salesperson? They say a name, and I say, why? They say, well, they bring in the most money. You know, and I say, define bringing the most money. Well, they have the biggest accounts. But what they're really answering is they're saying they're the best salespeople because they're bringing in the most revenue. But mm-hmm. not necessarily. In almost all cases, those people, to get that revenue, they've had to cut margins. So they're many times selling for less money than someone who may be number three on the list, you know, that's bringing in you know, a little bit less money, but bringing in revenue, but bringing in substantially more profit. So what I try to get business owners to do is stop looking just at the top line and really focus, you know, focus 80% on that bottom line mm-hmm. and 20% on the top. Because the other question I ask people all the time, Dave, is what would you rather be? Would you rather own a company with $10 million in sales and you're bringing in $3 million mm-hmm. or $100 million in sales and you're bringing in $1 million? You'd
right.
be surprised. You know, everyone says I'd rather make $3 million, but not enough people conduct themselves in their business like they would answer that question.
Got it. Now, when you think about getting to that profitability, are you, in terms of, you know, there's always a limited amount of time that the business owner has. Do you tend to think about the business as how do we cut, like, production and other costs first and maybe, you know, office costs, or do you think about more of raising revenue when you do have sort of a choice between the two, or you always have to be thinking about both?
No, it's difficult. I mean, you've hit one of the most difficult things on the head, and it has to do with time. You know, if you're a business owner, many businesses, the one that you mentioned in the introduction, you know, I had to sell, even when it was making $40 million, I was still bringing in 80% of that revenue and
right.
had to run the business at night. That's very unhealthy.
Right.
You know, not only physically for the business owner,
right.
but actually for the business.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a dilemma that you have. But really, for me, it's an analysis. You take a look at it and you say, what's the biggest number? You know, if you have a restaurant and you find out that your food costs, you know, are 18%, mm-hmm. you know, or you find out that your payroll is 40%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, 40% of payroll, 18% in food, that's 58%, you know, and then you have all your SG&A, maybe is another, say, 20%. You're left with what, 13% you could possibly make on the gross level
mm-hmm.
or on the net level? You know, you're limiting yourself, so you could take a look at that and say, what's the biggest impact I can make? Well, you
right.
know what, maybe it is payroll. If it's 40%, you know, I have $1.4 million in payroll. If I can get this down to $1 million, you know, without really cutting service, I've just dropped $400,000 to the bottom line. Significant.
Got it. Now, in that situation, what would be your thoughts on, well, if I increase revenue, then the percentage of payroll would actually go down? Or would you possibly think about, hey, do we have to cut payroll?
Well, that's a great that's the great hedge, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we get ourselves into trouble because you're right. If you could get another big customer, just say, that brings in, you know, 10% more on the revenue line without you increasing your costs or your SG&A,
right.
what have you done? Well, of course, you've lowered all your percentages. But what happens many times is we staff up maybe a little bit early, so we're incurring those costs too early.
Mm-hmm.
Many times those accounts don't come, so we're kind of overstaffed a little bit for that, which is a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, again, the thing is that I always talk to people about in their businesses, even when they're small, you know,
mm-hmm.
what kind of processes can you put in place to make your life easier, to
mm-hmm.
make your business more efficiency, which one kind of begets the other. But on the upside to that, which is kind of cool, is if you ever are interested in selling your business, those processes, that's what's going to yield you a higher range of a sell price. Businesses like to buy process. So there's no, everywhere you look, there's benefit to processing your business, even when it's very small. And
mm-hmm.
when you can do that, aside from the obvious benefits of less payroll because you have systems and processes in place,
mm-hmm.
it's more depend, you know, it's more not dependent on the business owner. And
Got
that's
it.
A big, big relief too. And then you have time to look at those other things that we mentioned.
Excellent. Now, can you give some examples of systems and processes so everyone listening could really think about that and how they can create systems and processes for their
sure,
businesses?
Sure, of course. If you own, you know, I don't know, there's many different businesses, but I don't know, just say you own a dry cleaner, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and someone brings a ticket in and there's someone's at the front and they take your clothes and they write a ticket and they give it to person A who sorts it and they give it to person B who, you know, who does the you know, the cleaning part of it and person C who does the steaming part of it. If that process, you know, if it touches five people, it doesn't really need to touch five people. You know, can it touch three people?
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, then what you've done is you've, you know, for two of the people, it's not necessarily maybe you need them, maybe you don't, but the success of the delivery to the customer is enhanced because it goes through less fingers. You know, goes
right.
through less, it's touched. And it could be, you know, the same holds true. You know, you get big companies like Motorola and Oracle and Procter & Gamble I've worked with. It's the same thing. It's the same
mm-hmm.
thing as a cleaner, only it's a lot bigger.
Right.
You know, how many things touch many, you know, from customer to delivery. And that's, I kind of, in the Be the Elephant book, I kind of go through it in detail. But you start from the end of it. You start with from the delivery to the customer. And then you go back literally each step in your process. What happens if you deliver that all the way through the selling of it?
Got
and
it.
Then you look at that and you say, where is there redundancy? Where can I shorten it up? You know, this is the same thing that a McKinsey would do or, you know, or one of these other big consulting companies. And I've used them and I've paid them, you know, $2 million to do this. You could do it yourself, you know,
mm-hmm.
if you have the time to do it. And it's well, well worth it. And that's where, you know, your efficiencies then can convert to, again, dollar saves and better customer service and that kind of thing.
Excellent. So it's, I think that audit's a great idea to do that audit. And you're saying walk through all the way from delivery to the actual sales process, the entire customer experience, the cycle.
Yeah, start from the end, not
start
from the sales. Start from the delivery of the product and go all the way, delivery of your service, and go all the way back until you have the first contact in the sales front.
Got it. And then you're creating a better, after you go through that, getting rid of the redundancies, getting rid of the efficiencies, creating a system and process, and I guess documenting that process so that you have that in paper, probably easier to train people and hire people as well?
Absolutely, and it also sets the architecture for growth.
Right.
If your company's going to grow, you kind of see who's doing what, because one of the things that we advocate when you talk about your strategy for growth, and not to get way off on a tangent here, but when you grow, there's two ways to grow. That's
mm-hmm.
it. You know, you could sell new stuff to the same people or the same stuff to new people. That's it. So
right.
when you look at it that way, you know, and you have your process, you know, you say, you know, if we're ready to grow, we get a big customer, or we get more services, or we grow, you know, vertically or horizontally, you know, where do we need to beef up? Well, you take a look at your process, and you could begin to say, you know, what's the throughput on each of these departments, whether it's, you know, legal or advertising or marketing or technology, wherever it is, you know, you could begin to take a look and say, you know, how does this streamline, or where do we need to fatten up to handle that growth? And it becomes a much more solid framework of an organization.
Excellent. Excellent. I want to move now to sales. And by the way, I love this interview because most people I speak to are experts in maybe one area like HR. And with your background
yeah.
and everything that you do, you're an expert in so many different areas. So it's pretty exciting for me. So I appreciate
that. I'm trying not to be too all over the place.
No, it's good because I think that in every area you have a lot of nuggets of very valuable information, which is great. I do want to move over to sales, and I know you do a lot of sales training and a lot of sales training seminars and workshops. I think you even have DVDs, and I think that's on your website at stevekaplanlive.com. And I was wondering if you can just sort of talk us through sales and start with, you know, what are the keys to maximizing sales? What are the things that most companies do wrong that they should be doing?
Well, I think a lot of times, first of all, my philosophy is I would rather, it's easier for me to get, you know, 3 big sales than 3,000 small sales.
Okay.
So why would I waste my time doing 3,000 small sales? And that doesn't matter. That's not dependent on the kind of company that you have, by the way. I mean, you know, any company can get big customers, and that's really what I try to advocate. Get big customers, big customers. And it doesn't matter. I mean, you can have a print shop. You can have a sandwich shop. Certainly the ones that are B2B, you know, technology companies, consulting companies, that's a no-brainer because they're out there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But even, you know, people that are part of your network that have small companies that they don't think of them as being positioned for corporate or big company, you know, they're not thinking big enough. Because
right.
any company, and that's the biggest mistake, you know, not mistake, but that the biggest kind of shortfall that people make, is they don't think of, you know, those big customers.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they do, another difficulty thing with them is, you know, is they get, a lot of times they get caught up in the bureaucracy that is these companies.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing for me, the most successful thing, if I had to put my finger on, for my ability to get, I've had over 300 of the Fortune 500 as customers at one point or another,
mm-hmm.
in one business or another. And the ability to do that has clearly been the ability to turn and leverage their bureaucracy to your advantage.
Okay.
And it's not an easy thing to do if you really don't know how, but the trick of it really is to understand that the bureaucracy is made up of people. The people that hate the bureaucracy the most are the people inside those companies.
Right.
You know, it's not like they don't want to have smaller companies for suppliers. They actually do. But
mm-hmm.
what happens is many of us don't give them the opportunity to say yes because we present ourselves in too risky of a way.
Right.
You know, we're in there. We're talking to someone who's an information gatherer, which is the case. Many decisions are made by committee. And we're
mm-hmm.
talking to them as if they are the purchaser. Instead of giving them background information and giving them one top-line sheet with 5 bullet points on it, so
mm-hmm.
that when they're in the room, they can plead our case with nothing more than those 5 bullet points, and we're looking good. You know,
right.
We don't do that enough. You know, we forget about that, and we talk to them like we're trying to sell an influencer.
Got it.
That's another thing. You know, so you know, getting in there and understanding them and getting these customers. These are some things that it's a science and an art, but you can get there because you know. Hundreds of people who have no problem.
Mm-hmm. What about in terms of Salesforce management? What have you found in your career in terms of hiring and motivating your Salesforce?
Well, I'm first and foremost, I consider myself a sales guy, even though I've owned a bunch of businesses, and that's what I love to do. You know, I just do.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, in your organization, the best sales managers I have weren't necessarily the best salespeople, and you've heard that before.
Right.
It's a different care. You know, it's an organizationalist is the sales manager. It's you know, if you want to recognize a great salesperson, you know what? Don't make him your sales manager. Give him more money.
Right.
You know, that's what they want anyways, if they're, you know, most likely. So that's the biggest mistake that I see is not doing that. But the thing from an organization, from a business owner standpoint, is to be responsive to them. I mean, I kind of treated my sales forces, all of them, and I still do even today, as almost like, even though they're not, almost like as independent entrepreneurs. Like their book of business, you know, their customers, that's their business.
Mm-hmm.
They need to own them. They need to, you know, they're responsible for them. But it puts the burden on me to and the rest of the organization to give them what they need. If they need quotes, you know, they can't wait 2 weeks for quotes. They need quotes. If they need sales and materials to sell, they need them, you know. And so it's really being responsive. And in a way, you kind of have like your customer, like your company is almost a supplier to your sales force in a way. And it's kind of a weird way to look at it. But, you know, if your salespeople in a way are your customers, you're trying to motivate them to get out there and sell, it becomes a little more clear.
Got it. That's pretty interesting to think of your salespeople as your customers, as the manager. I think it's a really interesting way of looking at things that you have to satisfy them so that they can do a better job.
Yeah, and it's a balance, you know what I mean? Because they are employees, you know, in many cases. You know, so, you know, I'm not by any you know, by any manner, shape, or form of having management, you know, appear like beholding or weak or anything like that.
Sure.
It's not the thing. The thing is you're in it together, and
right.
What's going to happen is what's going to make them motivated. This is salespeople, which are different than operational people, different than managers.
Mm-hmm.
Salespeople, if they can make a lot of money. Most of them don't necessarily want to win a trip. They want to get the money. They'll buy their own trip.
Right, right.
You know? And so, you know, it's not that I'm being callous about it. I'm just being realistic about it. So,
right.
You know, give them what they need to be their own independent, you know, and own their own companies and make sure that you lock them up in terms of good non-competes and make sure you're protected by that because you don't want to be, on one hand, so, you know, so responsive and giving all this stuff. They get this great book of business and then they leave on you.
Right.
You know, I mean, they're probably to leave on you, but they can't take their business with. That's yours.
Right, right.
You know, so you want to protect yourself on that. But then you want to really support them as much as you can. I made it, you know, when I'll give an example. For a while, I had one of my big customers was Procter & Gamble, and I was billing them quite a bit, about $30 million a year. And I had business with about 70 brands across probably six divisions of that company. It was big. Mm-hmm. I was there all the time, and it was a great experience, and I really loved it. But you know, I had some things to do outside of that. I had to grow a business. I had to sell a business. I had a lot of things, personal growth I wanted to do. So I had to get out of that account, and I owned the business at that time. So I hired four salespeople to split up the divisions with them. And, you know, but I put the time in. I made them follow me for a whole year, you know, on this and the team. And it's more about learning the relationships and learning the inner workings of that organization and learning the language, which is something we could probably touch on as a quick takeaway for your network there. But but after that, after they turn it over to them, within another year, you know, that 30 became 50.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pending the timing with them and know that you're vested as an owner. You stand behind your product. And it's not easy because there's other things you'd rather be doing. But giving them that support really goes a long, long way. And it's not just cursory support. You got to be there. And that makes a difference.
Excellent. What did you start talking about with language?
You know, something that it's interesting thing with businesses and with these big companies. And it's one of these tips. Whenever I even give a keynote or a 45-minute talk, I always bring this up because it's something that everybody listening can start tomorrow and they can actually impart this on their business and it can make a difference. It's a real simple thing. But we're sitting there talking here, and we're talking English, and, of course, everybody's understanding and hearing. But if we're in a cafe, and Dave, you and I are talking, and we're in, Prague or something like that, we stick out. We're tourists, right?
Right.
Well, if you go in these big companies, and you don't understand their language, and they all have them, by the way, you're a tourist. So what I advocate is get in that company and be a local, and it's so easy to do. Ask the receptionist, even when you call. What's the name of the headquarter building? What's the name of the production facility in Winston-Salem? What do you call the technology office? They'll have code names for all that. What do you call a contract? If I'm in there and I'm saying, hey, Dave, you know, I want to send, you know, this sounds pretty good. Can I send you a contract? and you call it Form 15B,
right.
What's it telling you? You know, I'm your first one. You know, big companies aren't in risk. But if I say, can I send you a Form 15B, even if it's my first one,
right.
It's going to be a lot smoother. It says different things. If I say to you, hey, I'm going to be in New York, I'm going to be in there, I'm going to be in your building, you want to, meet at noon, that's different than if I say, Dave, I'm going to be there, you want to sit down in conference room W4?
Right.
And it's easy. You just look, and so you keep, I used to keep a pad with me. And as I walk the halls, as I, you just look. Initiatives, big companies, they promote initiatives that they have and big things that they're doing. And chances are, in the area that you're selling, there's going to be corporate initiatives. Learn them and use them. I used to sell targeted marketing. Well, one of these companies called it POM, Point of Market Entry. Mm-hmm. What was it? Targeted marketing.
Right.
This was a simple thing of my letterhead, my proposals. I didn't say targeted marketing. All my competitors did. I said, I sold POM. Well, I killed them. I mean, I wiped the floor with them. They didn't have a chance because I was selling what the customer was buying. But they told me. The other people just didn't listen. So it's an easy thing to do.
I love it. It's I love ideas like that are so simple, that make such intuitive sense, that most people just overlook. And I think these speaking language, that's a great idea. I love it. I think it's definitely something that everyone should do. So I think it's a great that alone is enough value for someone to listen to this. This is great.
Great.
A question I have for you, back up to your Procter & Gamble example. In hindsight, and if you were advising another business owner, would you have brought in other salespeople earlier before you had 30-some-odd accounts and was going to take you a year to hand them off in order to better grow the business? Do you think that you did it too late, or would you advise someone to do that earlier?
Tough question. For me, it turned out beautifully.
Okay.
But it was, I think, a set of circumstances, if I can just be honest. I think it was a set of circumstances. Like, I don't know that I would advocate that. But the thing that I was able to do, because it was me, I didn't have any communication issues in between the parties calling on that company. So I was able to go to all the resource departments, purchasing. I was able to go to, the marketing support groups, the production, the supply groups. I was able to coordinate that with the same message, and I was able to come up with kind of cool, which I talk about in the Bag the Elephant book in detail, but I was able to come up with all these interesting processes for them, like that we did when my company had 20,000 in sales and 2 employees. We actually invoked process at Procter & Gamble with a couple of these things of reporting revenue savings for purchasing.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we do that? Well, because that was what their interest was in terms of, that one person, what they were looking for for their career. So how do you make, how do you solve their needs? Fine, you give this report and you go. So I was able to do all that stuff and coordinate all that, and once that was all and the relationship was solid, then I was able to get people in. So in hindsight, what I would try to do is build those relationships faster so that it would go shorter. But the relationship still needed to happen, I think, first. Maximize every dollar out of there,
Excellent. Let's switch gears a little bit to marketing. Can you talk about establishing your unique selling proposition and how that affects marketing and sales?
Sure. To me, unique selling propositions are kind of an interesting thing. I'm a big branding guy, and this has to do with pretty much anything, because it's effective. It works. People want something that they could grab onto, something tangible, and brands and logos and names and acronyms, that kind of told the day. So I try to develop a unique selling proposition in a lot of scenarios. For example, if there's something that I'm better at than all my competitors, I want to promote that through a unique selling proposition. I want to define it. I want to come up with a name with it, and I want to march it around. And the complete opposite, if there's something that my competitors are way better than me at, I'm going to want a unique selling proposition. I'm going to want to hit it head on. I'll give you an example. There was a business I had that did a lot of shipping, a lot of delivery of things. And we were new, and our competitors were saying, hey, Steve's company, how do you know that this stuff gets where it's supposed to get?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know it's not ends up in a landfill or wherever? Now, the fact is that we did, of course, deliver on what we were doing, but scaring away a potential customer, and that's an age-old tactic, it goes back forever. So what I did, I used to avoid that issue of security in my speeches, in my presentations. And I sat down with my sales force one day. I'm like, guys, you know, we're going about this the wrong way. So what we sat in that room and we developed some uniqueness to how we actually shipped. We ended up we were using UPS at the time, but mm-hmm. it was a while ago. But what we did is we came up with this cool name called Sample Track. Mm-hmm. And what Sample Track does is it's very commonplace now. But what it does is there's a UPC on the barcodes on the packages, and you read them, and you can go online, and you can go ahead and you can plot the delivery. You can see the signature. Mm-hmm. UPS gave us a access code, which we gave our customers, and that's all fine in terms of the logistics of it. But mm-hmm. the thing we did is we came up with that name, Sample Track. We branded it, TM. We came up with a great sell sheet, and what we did is that's the first thing we led with in our sales presentations. The first thing, which was our weakest, because
right.
we were new, was, how do you know your stuff's going to get where it's going to go? Well, Sample Track, that's why. We would walk them through our sell sheet. It was in writing with a cool logo.
Right.
And never had the problem again, And so doing that again and again and again is great. And also, like I said before, if you do go to sell your business, that ladders up. That Sample Track has value that you're selling.
Right, the brand value of that.
Everyone, all of them, yeah.
Excellent. I love that. I love that. So you basically were able to attack the weakness by making it a positive, by branding or creating a word, Sample Track, TMing it, and creating a system. What about if the problem is, or the challenge is, price? No one wants to, really grow a business as a low-cost competitor. What are your thoughts on competing against somebody at a lower price than you?
Well, that's always a difficult, especially today,
Right.
When you're faced with that, there's a couple of things. We all try to sell value, right? Everyone will tell you
right.
that. They should tell you that. They want to understand our value. There's a couple of things with that. First of all, when you're selling an existing customer, if you're doing your job correctly, mm-hmm. after the previous sales, they should begin to understand value. The money, the companies I made the most from were mm-hmm. the companies that I sold the most to.
Right.
So I made more on my biggest customers than I did on the new ones because
right.
they understood what I was doing, and there's a safety, security aspect to all of that kind of thing. When you're out there facing somebody that is selling on pretty much 100% price point, mm-hmm. You have to address it. It's fine to sit there and say, we use the highest quality, blah 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 blah. In today's
right.
day and age, customers are less concerned about that and more concerned about their bottom line and keeping their job.
Right.
So the way I combat this is I try to get something on the other end. I try to say, we have all this value. We're better than them because of X, Y, and Z, and that. But I understand your position. So why don't we look at this? Why don't we look at a volume contract?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we look at a 3-year contract that's going to secure your pricing, but it's going to give us the scale and volume that we need to go ahead and give this back? Maybe it's the same money that you're going to, or a little more, or whatever, the same money as the other guy, but you're getting this much more value in the stuff, customer service that we do. And what I'm getting, and you may share this or not, I'm getting, 3 years of a guaranteed customer.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be surprised how that works. That's how I've done that before, and it's worked well, because for me and a lot of the businesses, that I had that aren't, before they got to be really big,
mm-hmm.
the prospect of having a guaranteed customer, a big customer for 3 years, having a Quaker or having a Sprint or having an AT&T or a Motorola, having them for 3 years, pretty good.
Right.
You got some good solid cash flow coming in there. And over time, I also understood that once I had a long-term contract, or once I had volume, that's only the beginning. I would have made more on incremental things over those 3 years. Then I knew that for every dollar I sold, I made 30 cents incremental over the terms of that contract.
Got it.
So once we get in there, you're navigating that company, you're turning that price situation, right, into not only an opportunity for cash flow, and by the way, I'm not saying you should drop your shorts and lose money. No way. You,
mm-hmm.
There's a point at which you have to say no.
Right.
If you're in there and you do get that go-ahead and you're walking around there, that's just the beginning, because that's the door opening wide for you, because you're in there for 3 years or 2 years, and you're part of their team now. So that's a whole separate thing. You've just, turned a bad situation into probably the best potential future sales situation you could ever have.
Got it. So you're obviously a big fan of customer lifetime value and getting in there and leveraging.
Absolutely. I mean, you're going to get so much more out of selling deeper in a company than you will by getting new ones. It's you know, and the thing is with the strategy that I like, it, you know, you don't need, you know, you could have three businesses depending on what you're selling, mm-hmm. but you can have a handful of customers. You can have a $100 million business, no problem, depending on what you're selling, of course.
Right.
You know, but it's there. I mean, all my growth, well, not all, but most of my growth that I've done in my businesses have been paid for by my customers.
Right.
It's very rare that I put money up in front and said, I want to expand in this market. Because I would think, you know what, if I can't sell this on concept and get someone to pay for it, then how good is it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are existing customers that knew me. You know what I mean? And so a lot of expanding into a lot of the foreign markets, coming into, you know, opening up offices. Many times, I opened up I ended up buying a company in China. Well, I got there, and Procter & Gamble paid me to do a consulting job over there because mm-hmm. I just replicating what I was doing here over there. So I went to, and I never did that before. So I asked them about it because I knew I was going over there, and I, got, you know, and the trip was paid for because of that, you know, and I had a good in, and I went in there, you know, under, kind of under their name, and it made everything more smooth. So, I mean, it happened many, many, many times with many companies. But, you know, if you really, once you get in these big elephants here, you know, you can really, you know, really, really go crazy, even in this economy, you know.
Excellent. What about HR and looking at, as a business owner, identifying, keeping, and motivating employees? Any tips and tricks that you've picked up along the way?
Yeah, a couple. I mean, you know, and also a lot of this stuff, I hope everyone understands, a lot of this stuff is stuff I did wrong. I far from did everything right. A lot of the stuff I learned, I messed up, I was able to correct it, I did better. But the thing I'm so fortunate about is I had so many opportunities to do it over and over again that eventually I was able to get it right, you know. And so some of these things on motivating, identifying people, you know, it's funny. You mentioned on the offset a company I had of about $250 million. It mm-hmm. ended up going part of a group that was $1.3 billion. And with that, my top employees, the ones that were actually making the most, a couple of them never even went to college.
Right.
You know, one of them started with me at $7 an hour as a telemarketer. She mm-hmm. ended up overseeing about 30 people. She was making, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. You know, she was a great employee. So the thing for business owners to take a look at is, if your business is going to make it big, it's not solely going to be because of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in many cases, it will be in spite of you, but it's
right.
not going to be solely because of you. So the thing is, you know, is to build, you know, you and many have, many business owners are wonder great with this, but you know, you're kind of building, like, in a way, a family. You know, and that's how a lot of business owners look at their employees, you know, and so,
right.
you know, there's good and bad with that too. But some things that I would always do is a couple of rules. If I heard news,
mm-hmm.
I would, and it took me a while to get like this, because you could probably tell I'm a pretty passionate guy, and, you know, but
mm-hmm.
What I would do, I'd have like a 30-second rule. You know, I wouldn't really show anything, good or bad, you know what I mean, for 30 seconds.
Right,
and you'd be surprised, you know, to blow up at somebody and embarrass them in front of their coworkers and it has ramifications, had ripple effects that you don't really think about, you know,
right.
And it adds up over time, and it gets to the point where your employees actually become resentful and look for a way to, you know, kind of get back at you,
mm-hmm.
And plus it's just not, you know, it's just not productive as a leader, you know, so
right.
that's one thing I would advocate. Another thing is spend time with the rank and file. You know, I'd always go back in the warehouse. I'd hang out with these guys, whatever, better football, square pools with these guys, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I would learn more from my organization from them, and I would talking to, you know, my Harvard MBAs, you know, by
right.
far, because they know what's going on. And, you know, and that's an important thing to do. You know, it also keeps the culture. You know, the culture is you many times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they see you leaving at 10 playing golf, you know, how hard are they really going to work at, you know what I mean, till 7, 8 at night, you know?
Right.
You know, and so, you know, that's an important thing as well, you know, and also confidentiality. I mean, if you, you know, many times business owners with smaller companies, you know, they'll tend to, because we don't have a lot of peers, you don't have any peers, really, if you're the guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it, because we don't have that, sometimes it's difficult, and we will you know, we'll go ahead and maybe say something that we shouldn't, you know, to these people.
Right.
Like, talk about an employer, tell a secret or something. You tell
right.
one person, it's not a secret anymore.
Right.
You know, And it's just a few just little simple things that really kind of, kind of make a difference.
Excellent. Totally agree. Question I have on sort of growing pains as you grow your company. Any advice as companies start taking off on things that they should have in place or mistakes that they should avoid in terms of growing too quickly or just growing their company?
Wow, that's a whole nother call, but let me give you a couple of them.
Okay.
Close your eyes. Imagine you're walking into your business tomorrow and your business is three times the size overnight.
Okay.
Can you handle it? That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. If the answer is no, which it probably is, you're not ready.
Right.
So the thing that I tell people to do is not to go out and go hire all kinds of people and all that kind of things. I'm a big revenue before SG&A guy,
right,
as you probably can imagine.
Right.
But what you can do, you can develop processes and you can write down who you would hire, what you would do. You get a whole game plan together for when you get that revenue so that when you do get that customer, you press a button. You know what I mean? And it's gone. You need to have, you need to involve your managers in this, even if you only have three people in your company. All of them, get your assistant involved in it. She'll love it. She just gives her a feeling of belonging and more sense of meaningful work. They love it. You'd be surprised. Your assistant today may end up to be a department head 5 years from now.
Right.
Don't be surprised if that happens. It's happened to me before.
Okay.
If you're lucky, it happens.
Right.
And so, have them go ahead and research some things. If you're manufacturing poly bags, for example, and you're going after these big customers and big orders, and you can only do so many. Well, who are your outsource people that you can outsource them to fill your contracts so you meet them until your equipment is up, tested, and running? Once you have the order, then you can buy the equipment, but you're not going to buy it ahead of time. So
right.
You want to be able to take orders right now, so you're going to outsource it. Well, okay, so you bite the bullet. You hate to give away, 3 million bags or 5 million bags or whatever it is.
Right.
But you do it because, it's a risk-averse move. You get your equipment. You're still making money on that thing, and you're up for there, but you don't absorb the potential, death of buying a multimillion-dollar piece of equipment and having it sit there.
Excellent.
So, no matter what it is, if it's a people business, service business, it's the same, philosophy.
Excellent. Two more questions for you. One is on exiting. What's the one key tip that business owners should keep in mind and think about if they eventually plan to exit or sell their business?
The average business owner thinks about selling his business 2 to 3 times every day. That's interesting. And it could be for a fleeting second. Every bit of aggravation, it could be, I just don't want to deal with this anymore. It could be, wow, and that's the bad news. And the good news is, wow, I can get a better multiple now. So it's not so, it's not even so overt. Sometimes it's more subconsciously.
Right.
But it's there. The biggest thing is it takes time to prepare you. Preparing your business for a sale to get maximum value is very different than anything else. If you've never done it before, you need to plan on some time. You need processes. You need to say what's the business going to be like if you're not in it. If you want to stay in it, you still want to divest yourself of responsibilities. You can always negotiate an employment contract. And by doing so, I mean, that's what I did. I wanted to stay for a while, and so by by divesting myself of my business, I was able to step up, and I was able to go from running my $40 million business to buying, 30 businesses around the world in 3 years myself. I couldn't have done that if I was so immersed in my business, trying to protect myself, showing my buyer how important I am.
Right.
It depends on what you want to do, your personal goals. That's one thing. Another is you have to get brandable assets for them, like we talked about in the USPs. That's an important thing to maximize value.
Mm-hmm.
Understand valuation to get a right team together. And then think of your personal goals. What do you want to have? And with your personal goals are your employees. It's important to me to take care of my employees. It's not necessarily in everybody, but, for those it is, the time to do that is now.
Excellent. One last question for you.
Sure.
The last question is what else? What else should, if you're looking back and you're starting over, or you have a protege that's starting their business and they're young and they're or even they're older, they're starting their business, what other last piece of advice do you think that entrepreneur or business owner should know as they embark on their journey to successfully grow their company?
Well, there's a couple of things, but one of them is, if you're successful, your business in 5 years from now will not be what it is today. So mm-hmm. if you take that premise, then there's no other way to go in there but with flexibility and some vision, you know, as an opportunist within your core area, you know. And your business will evolve. If you're lucky, you know, you're going to identify key opportunities and you're going to be flexible enough to have your business steered on a kind of like a curvy but upwards path, you know, mm-hmm. that's going to ultimately lead into success.
Excellent. Everything you said was awesome, Steve. I really appreciate your time. Everyone, I've been speaking with Steve Kaplan. You can find Steve online at stevekaplanlive.com. Steve does a lot of stuff on his site. You can look through his books, his training as well. Steve, thank you so much for all your help today and all your great advice.
My pleasure. And also, Dave, just you know, for your network, there's a lot of free calculators and things they can use in their business. Just on the top, I think it says freebies. You can just click in there and sign in, and they're no cost.
So. Excellent. Steve, once again, thank you so much.
Take care, Dave.